Welcome to the Pediatric Physical Therapy Podcast. I'm Peter Goodwin. We've been talking with the authors of some of the studies reported in the latest edition of Pediatric Physical Therapy Journal. Coming up in this edition, TUGS and TUDS testing in children with Down syndrome.
The conclusion that we had was that the TUG test is reliable and could be a useful clinical measure of functional mobility for this age group with Down syndrome. The TUDS test, however, is not. And I think what we realized after the fact was encouraging kids to go as fast as possible on the stairs is maybe not the smartest way to test their functional mobility.
And help for children with cancer.
What we were needing was an intervention that would promote improved function with our children who were survivors of brain tumors.
Also, back pain and what physical therapy can do to help.
If you have back pain and have scoliosis, and that back pain really is a concern to you, then you should probably see a physical therapist more frequently than not.
Just some of the issues being raised in this edition of the podcast and discussed fully in the latest Pediatric Physical Therapy Journal. To begin with, then, in children with Down syndrome, should you use the timed up-and-go test, TUG, or the timed up-and-downstairs test, TUDS, or indeed both? Kathy Martin's group in Indianapolis conducted a study comparing the two methods in a group of 12 children. She told me more about it.
We've seen the minimal detectable change has been established for this test, the TUG test, for children with cerebral palsy. And so it's being used clinically with children with Down syndrome, but because of their cognitive disability, we're not sure, you know, if it's a reliable test. And so I think that was kind of the important thing, is if it's being used clinically, let's establish that it is indeed reliable for this population.
Right. Now, you've been looking at the TUG test, but you've also been looking at the TUDS test. Tell me about that and why you looked at both tests.
I was interested in the TUDS test because going up and down stairs is a very functional activity for children with Down syndrome. And so I thought, gosh, if there's this test out there that might be helpful, then let's see if it's reliable as well. And then it would give clinicians a way to assess progress over time in a very important functional test.
And what was the whole point about detecting minimal detectable change in these test readings?
What we're really looking for is to see if what a minimal number is that would represent true change in the child's performance and not just measurement error. So if the change is pretty small, it could just be measurement error, and we need to know whether or not the change that we're seeing could truly reflect a change in performance, or maybe not. It's too small to be meaningful.
Okay, so what did you do, and what did you find?
Well, with the TUG test, we found we had the children do 3 repetitions of the TUG at one time, and then we had them come back a week later and do 3 more repetitions of it. And what we found was that the TUG is indeed pretty reliable, and the minimal detectable change is only about 1.5 seconds, which is pretty reasonable. To me, it seems like if you get a change of 2 or 3 seconds, then you have some confidence in the fact that that does represent true change. For the TUDS test, we had quite a different result, and the minimal detectable change came out to be quite high. It was more than 12 seconds. And that just doesn't seem to be very reliable to me, in that that's a pretty large change that would be required to show it's a true change in performance and not just measurement error. So we did not feel like the TUDS test was as useful as the TUG would be.
Right. Now, this was a pretty balanced study as physical therapy tests go, and you've got kids from 3 to 17 years. What are your conclusions, and what are your recommendations coming from this?
Well, I think the conclusion that we had was that the TUG test is reliable and could be a useful clinical measure of functional mobility for this age group with Down syndrome. The TUDS test, however, is not. And I think what we realized after the fact was encouraging kids to go as fast as possible on the stairs is maybe not the smartest way to test their functional mobility, because on stairs, safety is more important than speed. And yet we were asking them to go fast. So, you know, I think stair climbing is still an important test, but we probably need to look at it qualitatively and not asking kids to do it for speed. And at least at the moment, we don't have a reliable way to measure their efficiency on stairs.
Kathy Martin, who's a professor in the Cranert School of Physical Therapy at the University of Indianapolis. Next, a fascinating look at therapy for children with brain tumors. Jessica Sparrow.
We had 9 children who consented to participate in the study, and they participated in a 3-week constraint-induced movement therapy program that was completed here at the hospital. And the program was designed to improve the function in their affected hemiplegic upper extremity. During the program, we implemented the kind of 3 main components of constraint-induced movement therapy, which is restraint of the non-affected upper extremity to promote use of the hemiplegic upper extremity, mass practice, or intensive practice of motor movement and functional activities in the affected upper extremity, and then also the principle of shaping, which is a psychological practice in which the tasks are successively graded to become more and more complex and more difficult until ultimately the final goal or the final motor pattern is achieved.
What did you find?
We found that all of our participants were able to successfully participate in this intensive intervention. We found that there were significant improvements in the frequency of use of their affected upper extremity, as well as in the quality of use of their upper extremity. And we found that those improvements were maintained at a 3-month follow-up. So 3 months after the completion of the study, they were reevaluated, and all of those parameters on a variety of different assessments remained significantly improved, except for one.
It sounds like good news all around. What are your recommendations to other clinicians coming out of this?
Yes, so you know, we feel that this intervention is definitely a feasible and effective intervention for children with brain tumors, and we made a few modifications to the program for this unique population. We were mindful of concerns related to skin integrity, because children who are completing cancer treatments and have had cancer have potentially are at risk for skin integrity issues. So particularly related to the restraint that we use, we had regular skin checks and were very mindful of that during the program. We also were very mindful of a few other cancer-related issues that can impact a child's participation in the program, such as fatigue. Cancer-related fatigue and on-treatment fatigue is a very common issue for children who are having who are experiencing cancer, and that could definitely impact a child's ability to participate in this very intensive program.
That was Jessica Sparrow, who works for the Rehabilitation Services of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. And with me on the line from California is our editor-in-chief, Linda Fetters, from the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Linda, what do you make of what Jessica had to say about physical therapy for children with brain tumors?
It's very helpful to see Dr. Sparrow's work on constraint-induced interventions now being applied to a new population, and that's children who have brain tumors. This type of intervention, the constraint-induced movement therapy, has been used primarily with infants, children, and adolescents with a hemiplegia due to cerebral palsy. It's been a very effective intervention in terms of increasing the amount of use of the arm that's been most affected by the hemiplegia, and also improving the quality of the use of the arm. And what Dr. Sparrow and group have demonstrated is that this same type of intervention with very similar features to the intervention that's been used with children with cerebral palsy can be effective in promoting function in this population of children with brain tumors.
Brilliant. Thanks, Linda. More from you a bit later on, if I may, please. An objective measure of foot structure to monitor children with flat feet over a period of time. That was the focus of research by Lisa Dreyfus and her colleagues in New York City. And she's been telling me more.
Well, it's really common as a pediatric therapist or a therapist that we get patients with a flat foot, and there's not a gold standard of how to measure it. So what we wanted to look at is there's an arch height index, which is a measuring device that is being used in adults in both clinical as well as research, but is not really being used in the pediatric population. So we wanted to ensure that this device is reliable in this pediatric population in order to further use it for both clinical and research.
Right. So what did you do? How did you go about this?
We had 30 healthy children between the ages of 6 to 12 years of age, and they came into, we happened to do the testing at our motion analysis lab, and we tested in both sitting and then standing to look at their arch height. So the measurement is a system in which it's a device that you put the heel and you measure the full foot length, you look at the truncated foot length, and then specifically are measuring the dorsal arch height.
Right, and you got different people to measure the same kids, didn't you?
Yes, so we did both intra and inter-rater reliability. So two clinicians measured each subject twice. So we were able to look at the reliability amongst two different clinicians as well as amongst yourself, and we found it was reliable in both cases.
Okay, well, I was going to ask you what you found, so give me a little bit more on that. What did you find in a nutshell? The test was good.
We found that according to your ICC 2-to-1 statistical analysis that both the intra and inter-rater reliability was good, if not excellent, in both the sitting and the standing for arch height index in this population we tested, which were healthy children.
So what are the recommendations coming out of this about arch height index then as a measure of foot structure in children?
So what we really wanted to find is if we can start using this in children, because there is a gap in clinical as well as in research, measuring and looking at truly the arch height of individuals and what is done clinically for treatment. And so what we would like to see in future studies is starting to use the arch height index as an objective measure to really not only be used research, but also clinically to monitor change over time in children who come in with flat feet, as well as if there's an intervention being done, whether it's physical therapy or orthopedic intervention or different orthotics that might be used, if it's helping improve their arch height index for kids who have flat feet.
Lisa Dreyfus from the Pediatric Rehabilitation Department at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. American and Chinese children with cerebral palsy can be assessed by similar tools, according to findings written up in the latest Pediatric Physical Therapy Journal. Ai-Wen Huang from Changgung University in Taiwan, together with her joint Swedish-Taiwanese team, used a GMFCS test to measure motor function and a Chinese version of the Activities Scale for Kids Performance Questionnaire, ASK-PC, to check on activity. And the relationship between these two measures was established, as she's been telling me on the telephone from Taiwan.
We find that this positive correlation between each measures for the different levels of severity, except for level 2. For other levels, we find significant correlations, especially for the more severe group. It means if we provide more opportunity for the children to participate in activities, we can expect a better capacity.
Right, and you have now got documentation because you're able to use these scores to assess exactly what you're doing and what you've achieved.
These two measures is quite popular for physical therapists. So maybe for intervention, we can apply these two easily in our clinical settings or in their daily livings for parents or the youth.
So is that what you've mainly discovered, the fact that you can confirm that these measures are good?
Yes, we have tested the reliability. It's translate into Chinese with the developer's permission. And we also test the test-retest reliability.
So could you give me a very brief summary of what it is you have found? How would you sum that up in a few words?
This study provides us information about different aspects of children's capacity and performance. If we want to improve our service, we can think of the relationships in different severity level and to provide children more comprehensive intervention program.
Ai-Wen Huang, who's an associate professor in the Department of Early Intervention at Chang'an University in Taiwan. Very interesting. I'm sure you'll agree, Linda, over there in California. I wonder, though, the story we heard before about arch height index, what do you make of that as a method of assessing pediatric flat feet, who we were just hearing just before Ai-Wen spoke?
Yes, it's good to hear from our colleagues in Taiwan and Dr. Huang and colleagues. Excellent work. The work on the arch height index is important in that Dr. Dreyfus has taken what she describes as a common problem in children and given us a way to document potential effectiveness of our interventions. It's often difficult to have effective measurement tools that help us to demonstrate change. And it's particularly helpful to have this type of an index for a problem that is common, that is often treated. And now we have a quantitative measurement tool that we can apply to assess the status of the problem, both before therapy and after.
So how important is it to get these measurements really accurate to be confident about your data?
It's critical to have accurate measurement and also to have measures that are responsive to change. We can accurately measure a phenomenon, but really not be able to demonstrate a useful or a functional change, and then those changes are really not helpful to the children that we serve. So this type of measurement tool, in increasing the number of measurement tools we have that are both accurate and sensitive to change is very important.
Thanks, Linda. Now, adolescents who have low back pain associated with idiopathic scoliosis have been investigated by Karina Zapata and her group in Dallas, Texas. She's been telling me what they set out to do and what they found.
The big issue was looking at the pain that our kids with scoliosis have and how two different physical therapy approaches might improve their pain. But we also looked at their activity, their satisfaction, and their disability associated with their back pain and having scoliosis.
Now, this was quite a carefully designed study because you had two groups, didn't you?
Yes, so we had a supervised group, which consisted of weekly physical therapy visits for a total of 8 weeks. And then we had an unsupervised group where we just gave them a one-time treatment and followed up with them after 8 weeks to see how they were doing.
And what happened?
After the 8 weeks, both groups improved, but the supervised group that had more physical therapy, they had lower pain intensities, so they improved more as far as their pain intensity was concerned. After 8 weeks, which was our article that we published last year, they also had improved activity levels, but at this manuscript that we published here at our six-month follow-up visit, they no longer had improvements with their activity levels, but they had also improvements with their satisfaction or their perceived changes due to physical therapy treatment. And their pain intensity was still better in the supervised group compared to the unsupervised group.
Can you tell me what we're learning from this in terms of possible changes in practice?
Here at our institution and at other hospitals, there are two approaches to seeing patients, and one of our approaches is that we just see them for a one-time visit, so an unsupervised visit. And there are other institutions where they do more the regular, standardized, typical outpatient physical therapy visits. And so if we have someone who is really concerned about their pain intensity, we have evidence here to suggest that seeing a physical therapist on a more regular basis would improve their pain significantly more.
Right. So let me distill out of this your basic recommendations. How would you sum up those?
Our recommendations would be that if you have back pain and have scoliosis and that back pain really is a concern to you, then you should probably see a physical therapist more frequently than not.
Karina Zapata from Texas Scottish Rite Hospital for Children in Dallas. Now, what's the best way to monitor the usual daily patterns of physical activity in youths and children who have cerebral palsy? Kristen Nicholson in Wilmington, Delaware, has been telling me about the protocol her team developed and why they needed it.
We know that youth and kids with cerebral palsy are less physically active or walk less than typically developing peers, and there's a need to encourage walking, you know, post-surgery or even just in their general lives. However, there wasn't a clinical protocol, something that could be consistently applied in order to measure this physical activity at home.
Right. So what did you do in the study that you've reported now?
So we sent close to 100 kids home with a stepwatch activity monitor, which actually just measures walking, not physical activity in general. So we sent that home for 8 to 14 days. And then they mailed it back, and we looked at how active the kids were. And then we ran a Spearman-Brown prophecy formula to figure out how many days would be required to get an idea of the average activity for a particular child.
Right, so they had this monitor for a whole bunch of days, but you didn't know whether that was overkill or underkill or what. Is that what it is?
Exactly. Yeah, so there were several other studies that said maybe 2 days is enough, or there were some that said, well, you need 8 days in order to get the average physical activity. And so we weren't really sure how many you really needed for this particular population. So some kids had it for 14 days, some kids only had it for 8 days. But either way, we figured that that was overkill, and we wanted to know how many they actually needed to get an accurate representation.
And Stepwatch, how are you normally recommended to use it?
The default settings are 15 days set at 60-second intervals, but that's for, like, average healthy adults. And so, you know, if you think about how active you are, you probably vary significantly from day to day, so you might need more to kind of get your average activity, whereas the kids with CP, we have found that they're pretty variable, but a little bit less variable due to their limitations.
Right. So what did you find with the kids with cerebral palsy then?
The number of days that you needed was different by GMFCS level. However, as long as you had 3 days, that would be enough for all GMFCS levels.
Now, as a result of making this study, what can you say in terms of actual hard guideline evidence about using this device to monitor the physical activity in children with cerebral palsy?
So the results, we recommend that you send it home for 7 days at a 10-second collection interval. And then once you get it back, as long as there's at least 3 days of data, then you can use it, and that will give a representation of the child's average physical activity.
So what's the overall take-home message for physical therapists who are monitoring kids with CP?
The kids are very variable, but as long as you have 3 days, that can give you a good idea of how active they are, and you'll be able to compare the data that you get to maybe other kids with CP or healthy kids to see how active your particular patient is.
That was Kristen Nicholson on the line from Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware. A case study is reported in pediatric physical therapy of a child with a severe burn to the foot and ankle. Miranda Yelvington in Little Rock, Arkansas, told me how they went about managing the scar optimally to minimize disability.
This case study tells the story of a six-year-old young lady who developed an aggressive hypertrophic scar at her foot and ankle. When she came for a follow-up in clinic, we found that with her shoes on, she looked very normal with her gross motor skills. But when barefoot, we noticed that she was unable to make toe contact with the ground in standing and walking. And this was really starting to affect how she performed her everyday skills, jumping, running, walking, all of those things.
What did you do? What did you assess? And what did you find?
The first thing that we did is we enrolled her in direct outpatient physical therapy. She was coming to PT, getting stretching, getting scar massage, and the normal gross motor treatments for someone her age. And what we found was as we progressed with this direct physical therapy treatment, while her ankle range of motion was improving, her toe contractures were worsening. This is actually pretty common because the scar itself is only allowed to stretch so much. So as the ankle required more skin length, her toes were contracting more.
What did you do about that?
I'm practicing as an occupational therapist who's been working for 17 years with burn survivors. The physical therapist who was directly treating the patient contacted me, and we started setting up a program to use multiple modalities or multiple forms of treatment to try to combat these aggressively forming scars. So we used an elastomere, which is sort of a moldable putty, and we formed it around her toes to provide stretch in that area. And then on top of that, we formed a thermoplastic splint to give us a toe flexion stretch while we were plantar flexing her ankle. And the combination of stretch and modalities on these two joints was able to elongate the skin and to reduce the hypertrophic scar.
Okay, so you're saying the multimodality approach works. Can you spell out what are the big things to do?
So for a multimodality approach, what you're trying to do is to provide a stretch as well as scar management at the same time while still working on direct therapy skills. So for this specific approach, we made this elastomere insert, which provided a flexion stretch for her toes. On top of that, she wore a splint to allow ankle and toe flexion. On top of that, she was also during the daytime wearing her compression garments and getting stretching and direct physical therapy. So it was a combination of many things working together to combat this contracture.
This was a six-year-old young lady.
It was.
You were successful. Can you quantify that success? Because obviously with a child that's growing, it's hard to know just how well you're doing and how much of an effect you've had.
She returned to normal toes on the ground and standing. Her gross motor skills were equal right versus left side following our treatment. We'll continue to monitor her for several years as she continues to grow because you always run the risk of the scar tightening as she's growing. It's obviously not going to grow at the same rate that her non-affected skin will grow. So it's something that we'll monitor over time. There may be a point where we need to do another round of splinting or another round of a multimodality approach. But for now, we started this case several years ago, and she's actually holding well with this treatment.
Could you give me one or two of the very brief take-home messages for occupational therapists and physical therapists coming out of this?
I think the therapist should continue to do the things that we learned in school, continue to do the stretching, the gross motor skills, the scar massage, all of those techniques. But when they're not working or when you reach a plateau and you find a scar that's worsening faster than you can make it better, you should consider doing other things. And, you know, adding an insert, adding an elastomere, adding a stretching splint at night in addition to the compression garments can really help you over that plateau and can really help make a difference in how the scars are forming.
Miranda Yelvington, who's an occupational therapist at Arkansas Children's Hospital in Little Rock. Linda Fetters, what are your thoughts about Miranda's approach there?
Miranda and her two physical therapy colleagues, Michelle Scoggins and Leslie White, have demonstrated excellent teamwork problem solving. They had a problem that was not responding to more typical treatment, and keeping the patient's functional interests in mind and looking to the future of what the initial problem or the presenting problems might mean, they really worked collaboratively and aggressively to solve the issues for this young child. And I think it's sort of the best of professional behavior and treatment that they've demonstrated in this case study.
It sounds to me as if it's quite an art using these different materials and optimizing how you combine them all.
Yes. Also, the layered approach of trying a set of intervention techniques first, evaluating their effectiveness. If not effective, what's the next round? If an individual such as Michelle and Leslie identified that they needed assistance from somebody with additional expertise and brought in Miranda, this is the type of sort of multi-layered approach to intervention that is certainly exemplary.
Thanks, Linda. Well, finally, more news about the modified ride-on car that Sam Logan's been researching in Oregon State University and elsewhere.
The previous modified ride-on cars we used were designed in such a way that children had to reach with their hand in order to press and activate them in order to use them for mobility. And so we took it sort of one step further, and we embedded a switch underneath the seat. So now a child had to stand up in order to turn the car on to use it for mobility and play.
Now, you've been testing this on a preschool child with a physical disability, and you've been comparing with other kids. Can you tell me exactly what you did?
We had about 42 preschoolers without disabilities and one preschooler with a physical disability. And we were really interested in comparing their physical activity and play interactions across the classroom, the gymnasium, and the playground. And due to the class space, he was not able to use the modified ride-on car in that space, but he did so in the gymnasium and playground alongside with his forearm crutches as well.
And what did you find, in fact?
So our main finding was that for physical activity, the children without disabilities and the one child with a disability were rather similar in the classroom and the gymnasium. However, the one preschooler with a disability engaged in more sitting and less running on the playground compared to his peers. In addition, what we found was that the one child with a disability engaged in different play interactions than his peers without disabilities, in that he tended to engage in less peer interaction, especially on the playground.
And what are the conclusions and kind of recommendations coming out of this? How do you interpret this work?
The one main finding that we really saw with using the modified ride-on car for standing was that during the playground, or on the playground, he spent more time engaged in direct peer interaction compared to when he was using his forearm crutches. And it also seemed that he engaged in about 10% less of teacher interaction on the playground as well when he used that modified ride-on car as opposed to his forearm crutches. And so one of the main recommendations that we have is that there are lots of different ways that we can provide mobility. And this standing modified ride-on car was one way that we could still work on that physical therapy goal of encouraging the skill from pulling from sit to stand and to bear weight. But it also allowed some added mobility in a different way that allowed him to travel across greater distances on the playground without becoming as fatigued as he typically was when he was using his forearm crutches.
And what then are your quick list of do's and don'ts for physical therapists in dealing with kids with disabilities and getting the best out of them, helping them develop to the best possibilities?
We really encourage clinicians to be able to provide multiple options for mobility for children with disabilities who may benefit from that mobility. And so really taking this right device, right time, right place approach, and recognizing that there is certainly times to work on those very specific physical skills, but there are also lots of times during the day when clinicians aren't available for that direct hands-on interactions. And so to provide other kinds of mobility experiences that may also simultaneously work on those goals of physical therapy, but a child can use them embedded within their real-world context with their peers throughout a typical day.
Sam Logan from Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. Let me give the last word, though, on this pediatric physical therapy podcast to you, Linda Fetters, our editor. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts about Sam Logan's and colleagues' work is that it's really playing to the child's strengths by evaluating how can we assist the child in socially interacting with their peers and using movement in a way that is fun as well as functional. And the ride-on cars have demonstrated just a wonderful opportunity to enhance children's mobility who have mobility compromises, and to do it in a way that's really fun. And it's fun for the child, it's fun for the family, and it's fun for the therapist. I really admire this work. And Peter, this gives me an opportunity to segue into a change that's has occurred or is occurring as we're speaking now and will occur for our first issue of Pediatric Physical Therapy in 2017. And that's a change of the format of our cover. The readers will see an example of the new cover and a photograph from Sam Logan and colleagues' work on the front cover, really demonstrating that physical therapy can be fun as well as functional. So I hope our readers will enjoy the new cover as well as Sam's work and all of the really extraordinary work that's represented in this new issue of Pediatric Physical Therapy.
Well, thanks, Linda. We're all looking forward very much to that. It's Linda Fetters from the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Thanks for all your help and thanks also for another fascinating edition of the journal. That's all we have time for now until next time. So from the Pediatric Physical Therapy podcast, from Linda and from me, Peter Goodwin, goodbye.